Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is a true crime in real time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Imagine this. You're on trial for murder. The jury deliberates for days. They talk, argue, think it through, then hung jury, mistrial. That's the official outcome. But what if, after all that, a few jurors pull you aside later and say, "Hey, just so you know, we actually did all agree you were not guilty. We just couldn't decide on one other thing." Now imagine the state says, "Great, let's do it all again. Same charges, new jury, let's roll." That's the situation Karen Reed's lawyers say she's in right now. And this week, they brought that fight to the front steps of the United States Supreme Court. April 3rd, 2025. While most people were checking out of their work week or figuring out dinner, Karen Reed's legal team was filing an emergency petition in Washington, D.C., arguing that her retrial violates one of the oldest rights in American law, protection from double jeopardy. You know, the one that says you can't be prosecuted twice for the same crime once you've been acquitted. It's baked right into the Fifth Amendment. Her lawyers say that's exactly what's happening, because according to them, the jury in her first trial already acquitted her. Not publicly, not officially, but in the jury room behind closed doors. And even though that verdict never made it to open court, her team argues it still counts. They say retrying her now is not just unfair, it's unconstitutional. Here's what makes this even more dramatic. They filed this petition while the second trial was already underway. Jury selection had started in Dedham, Massachusetts, just 2 days earlier. Prospective jurors were being questioned, vetted, seated. Meanwhile, her defense team was making a direct plea to the highest court in the country, asking them to slam the brakes on a retrial that, from their perspective, shouldn't be happening at all. Now, most defendants don't go knocking on the Supreme Court's door in the middle of a trial. That's like trying to get the referee to pause a football game while someone runs up to the owner's box to argue the rule book. But in this case, Karen Reed's attorneys say the stakes are too high not to try. Their petition claims that the first jury in 2024 had already fully decided she was not guilty on two of the three charges, second-degree murder and leaving the scene of an accident that resulted in death. The only charge they were hung up on, according to multiple jurors who spoke out after the mistrial, was involuntary manslaughter. But officially, none of that was recorded in court. No verdicts were announced. The trial was declared a mistrial across the board. And from the court's point of view, that meant the state could try again on all charges. Reed's team is now saying, not so fast. Their argument is this: if the jury in the first trial really did unanimously agree to acquit her on two charges, then double jeopardy protections should kick in, even if the public never heard that verdict. They claim those votes were final, that once all 12 jurors agreed she wasn't guilty, that should have been the end of the story, at least on those two counts. The idea being, just because the verdict never got spoken aloud in a courtroom doesn't mean the state gets a do-over. Now, to be crystal clear, this wasn't a secret conspiracy. There's no hidden tape of the jurors whispering "not guilty" into a recorder. What we're talking about are post-trial statements. After the mistrial was declared, at least five jurors came forward and said, yeah, we had all decided she was not guilty of murder and not guilty of leaving the scene. The only thing we couldn't agree on was manslaughter. So the trial ended without a final verdict, and from there, the whole thing reset. But if you're sitting in Karen Reed's defense chair, that reset button isn't just inconvenient. It's unconstitutional. Their Supreme Court filing is asking a fundamental question. Does a unanimous jury vote, if made behind closed doors but never delivered out loud, still carry the weight of an acquittal? Or, to put it another way, if a tree falls in the forest and 12 jurors hear it, does the law? The defense is banking on the idea that substance matters more than ceremony, that if all 12 jurors said not guilty in the deliberation room, that should count, even if they never made it to the finish line. The stakes are huge, not just for Karen Reed, but potentially for how mistrials are handled going forward, because if the Supreme Court agrees, it could change how judges handle hung juries across the country. Now, you might be wondering, what does this do to the current trial? Does the Supreme Court filing stop anything? Short answer, no, not yet. Filing a petition doesn't mean the court is taking the case. And unless they issue a stay, which they haven't, the trial goes on. Jury selection in Dedham is still rolling. As of April 3rd, several jurors had already been seated, and proceedings were continuing like nothing had happened. It's like a courtroom with two tracks running at the same time, one in Massachusetts, one in Washington, D.C. The lawyers are in both, hoping one of them pulls the emergency brake before the other reaches a verdict. It's a rare legal move, a high-risk one, and it tells us just how strongly Reed's team believes in this argument, or maybe how little confidence they have in getting a fair second shot. Either way, they're putting all their chips on the table. And to be clear, this isn't a case where the defense is claiming the evidence was weak or that the prosecutor made a mistake at trial. This isn't about misconduct or procedural errors. It's about a constitutional principle. They're arguing that the process of trying her again at all is the error. And the Supreme Court doesn't take kindly to that kind of claim lightly. The justices are flooded with thousands of petitions every year. They pick only a tiny handful. And when it comes to cases that are still in progress, like this one, they're even less likely to get involved. That's not speculation. It's just the numbers. Intervening mid-trial is something the court avoids unless there's a truly compelling constitutional issue. Whether this meets that bar is still up in the air. So for now, Reed's case marches forward. In Dedham, the jury is being built, the courtroom is being prepped, the witnesses are lined up, and in the background, the highest court in the land is deciding whether it even wants to hear the argument that could bring the whole thing to a halt. It's a collision course between procedure and principle, and no one knows yet which one will blink first, but one thing is certain. Karen Reed's legal team has made their position clear. In their eyes, retrying her is not just a mistake, it's a constitutional overreach, and they're not waiting for a verdict to say so. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at how we even got here, what happened in that first trial, how the mistrial unfolded, and why every court so far has said no to this double jeopardy argument, because before the Supreme Court gets to weigh in, it's worth understanding how many courts have already done so and why they weren't convinced. The moment Karen Reed's attorneys filed their emergency petition to the Supreme Court, they weren't starting a brand new legal argument. They were reviving one that had already been turned down loudly, clearly, and repeatedly. Before her defense team ever typed a word of that Supreme Court filing, they'd spent months walking this same legal path through multiple courtrooms. Each stop along the way delivered the same result. No dice. To understand how we got here, we have to go back to where this all started unraveling, the end of Karen Reed's first trial. It was summer 2024, and after weeks of testimony, the jury in Norfolk County Superior Court was sent off to deliberate. They were tasked with deciding whether Reed was guilty of second-degree murder, of leaving the scene of an accident resulting in death, and of involuntary manslaughter in the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe. After more than a month of evidence and about 28 hours of deliberations, the jury came back not with a verdict, but with an impasse. Judge Beverly Cannon, who presided over that first trial, ultimately declared a mistrial. The jury had told the court more than once that they were hopelessly deadlocked. In their own words, there was no sign of consensus, no inkling of agreement, as one note reportedly put it. That's the legal threshold for a mistrial due to a hung jury. And when that point is reached, a judge doesn't really have many options. If a jury can't come to a unanimous decision and says it clearly, the court has to stop. So that's what happened. Case over, at least for the moment. But here's where things took a turn. After the jury was released, after they were done, discharged, and no longer bound by courtroom rules, a number of jurors came forward and claimed that the group had actually agreed on some things, not officially, not publicly, but internally, inside the deliberation room. According to at least five jurors, they had all agreed that Karen Reed was not guilty of murder and also not guilty of leaving the scene of an accident. The only count they hadn't resolved, they said, was manslaughter. Now, if that had been communicated during the trial while the jury was still seated and active, the court could have taken what's called a partial verdict. That's when a jury reports they've agreed on some charges, but not others. In Massachusetts, as in many states, judges can accept those partial verdicts, read them into the record, and lock them in before declaring a mistrial on any unresolved counts. But that's not what happened here. In this case, the jury never told the judge they had reached agreement on any charges. They just reported being stuck. No verdicts were read, no polling was done, and no partial decisions were entered into the court record. The case ended procedurally as a full mistrial. So when Reed's lawyers came forward with this new information, jurors claiming they had acquitted her on two charges, they ran into a problem. The courts don't deal in what jurors might have thought or what they say they agreed to after the fact. Courts deal in what's been officially declared in court. If there's no verdict in the record, then legally, no acquittal exists. And that was the line Judge Cannon drew. Her ruling was firm. She said that because the jury never announced any decision in open court, and because they repeatedly stated they couldn't reach agreement on any of the three charges, the retrial could proceed. From her bench, there was no double jeopardy issue. No verdict had been entered. No charges had been resolved. The prosecution was within its rights to try again. That decision was appealed, and it climbed the ladder quickly. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court took the case next. Reed's legal team argued that the jury's unanimous vote, at least on those two charges, was real, meaningful, and should count as an acquittal, even though it wasn't made public. They emphasized that the jurors were unanimous, that they had finished deliberating, that their votes weren't just ideas being tossed around, but conclusions they'd all agreed to. But the SJC wasn't buying it. The state's highest court issued a lengthy opinion in February 2025 rejecting the claim. They acknowledged the jurors had come forward with statements about what was said in the deliberation room, but they made it clear post-trial juror statements cannot retroactively create a verdict. The court emphasized that for an acquittal to carry legal weight, it must be rendered formally, as either announced in court or documented through polling or a written verdict slip Anything short of that is just deliberation. The justices pointed to the fact that the jury never told Judge Cannon they had reached a decision on any individual charge. Not once during deliberations did the jury indicate they'd found common ground on two of the three counts. In fact, their final note to the judge said they were stuck across the board. And so the SJC concluded there was no error in the way the trial ended and no constitutional barrier to retrying the case. They also raised a broader concern. If courts were to start accepting juror affidavits after a mistrial as proof of a verdict, it could undermine the finality and integrity of the jury process. What's said in the deliberation room is protected for a reason. Allowing it to be dredged up afterward, by either side, could set a dangerous precedent. It would open the door to endless second-guessing, pressure, and reinterpretation of what jurors meant or didn't mean. The SJC was clear. That's not how trials work. So Reed's attorneys took the next step. They moved into federal court, filing a habeas corpus petition in the U.S. District Court in Boston. Again, they argued that retrying her on those two charges violated the Fifth Amendment's protection against double jeopardy. Again, they lost. The federal judge reviewing the case echoed much of what had already been said at the state level. No formal verdict had been issued. No acquittal existed in the record. There was no basis to stop a retrial. And most importantly, the court pointed to a Supreme Court precedent that essentially sealed the deal, Bluford versus Arkansas. That case, Bluford, involved a very similar situation. A jury had reported in open court that they were unanimous in finding the defendant not guilty of certain charges, but were hung on others. Before they could enter a formal verdict, the judge declared a mistrial. The defendant later argued that retrying him on those same charges violated double jeopardy. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court ruled against him. They said that until a verdict is formally recorded, there is no legal acquittal, even if the jury was unanimous, even if they said so publicly. Without a final accepted verdict, the prosecution gets another shot. That case has become the cornerstone of the arguments against Karen Reed's claim, and the federal appellate court, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, leaned on it heavily when they reviewed her team's appeal. In their March 2025 ruling, the First Circuit made it clear Reed's case is actually weaker than Bluford because in her trial, the jury never even announced in court that they had agreed on any counts. There was no foreperson stating the result. No note to the judge saying, "We've reached a verdict on two out of three." Just a mistrial. The First Circuit went on to say that even if we take the jurors at their word, even if we believe that all 12 of them agreed Reed was not guilty on murder and leaving the scene, none of them acted on it. They didn't deliver it to the court. They didn't present it as a verdict. And in legal terms, that's where it ends. The opinion went further. It warned against creating a standard where juror comments made after a trial could undo or override a judge's ruling. Because if we start letting jurors effectively issue verdicts after the fact, outside the courtroom after they've been dismissed, then no mistrial is ever really final. And that's a dangerous slope, both for defendants and for the system as a whole. So to recap this chapter of the legal journey, Karen Reed's team has made the double jeopardy argument in multiple courts, state and federal, and each one has come to the same conclusion. No formal acquittal means no double jeopardy. The jury's internal discussions, however sincere or unanimous, don't translate into a legal verdict unless they're delivered through the proper channels. That's not a technicality. That's the foundation of how the jury system works. Now, with all those losses behind them, the defense has turned to the final stop, the U.S. Supreme Court. The argument is the same, but the stakes are higher. Because if the Supreme Court agrees to hear the case and rules in their favor, it could rewrite the way mistrials and jury deadlocks are treated nationwide. That brings us right to the question, now hanging in the air, will the highest court in the land step in? Will it press pause on this trial or let it play out? And if it does weigh in, what exactly could that mean for Reed, for this case, and for everyone else watching? That's where we're headed next. At this point in the story, the courtroom in Dedham is moving forward like any other high-profile murder trial. Jurors are being selected. Legal teams are prepping opening statements. Judge Canone is ruling on motions. All the usual gears of justice are grinding ahead. But behind the scenes, there's a second clock ticking. Not in Massachusetts, but in Washington, D.C., where Karen Reed's emergency petition now sits quietly in the inbox of the United States Supreme Court. It's one of those strange moments where two versions of reality are happening at once. In one version, the trial is business as usual. In the other, Reed's attorneys are hoping nine justices might throw the brakes on the whole thing. But what are the actual odds of that happening? And more importantly, what happens next? Let's start with the basics. Filing a petition to the Supreme Court doesn't mean they'll hear the case. Not even close. In fact, most people don't realize just how selective the Supreme Court really is. Every year, the court receives around 7,000 to 8,000 petitions, formal requests for review. Of those, they accept somewhere between 60 and 80. Do the math, and you're looking at roughly a 1% chance of any given petition being heard, and that's for cases that don't involve the kind of time pressure and unusual procedural context that Reed's does. What makes Reed's case even more of a long shot is that it's happening mid-trial. The Supreme Court strongly prefers to weigh in on fully resolved legal issues, meaning after the trial is done, the verdict is in, and all the appeals have been exhausted. They typically want to see a complete record of the facts and the law, not a snapshot of a developing situation. Right now, there hasn't even been opening statements in the retrial. The trial court hasn't ruled on evidence issues, there's no jury verdict, and there's no conviction or acquittal to analyze. That's not to say the court can't step in during an active trial, it's just rare. For that to happen, the legal question at the center of the petition has to be urgent, fundamental, and clearly unresolved in the lower courts, and that's where Reed's case hits another wall. Her double jeopardy argument, while dramatic, doesn't exactly split the legal community. In fact, every court that's looked at it, from the trial court in Norfolk County to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court to the Federal First Circuit Court of Appeals, has said the same thing. No verdict means no acquittal. That's been the consistent position at every level, and it lines up directly with existing Supreme Court precedent. The most relevant of those precedents, of course, is Bluford versus Arkansas. We touched on it earlier, but the takeaway is this. Even if a jury says it unanimously agreed on a not guilty verdict in the jury room, it doesn't count unless it's formally delivered in open court and accepted by the judge. In Bluford, the jury told the court it had unanimously voted to acquit the defendant on capital murder, but was hung on a lesser charge. The judge declared a mistrial. The defense said retrying him on the capital charge would violate double jeopardy. The Supreme Court said it wouldn't. So unless the current justices want to revisit or overturn Bluford, there's no unsettled legal question here. No contradiction between courts. No constitutional crisis. That lowers the likelihood the court will see Reed's petition as something it needs to resolve urgently. From the court's perspective, the issue has already been answered. Legal scholars who've weighed in publicly echo that view. They're not dismissing the creativity of the argument, but most agree it's not a winner under current law. The fact that the first jury may have reached a private consensus doesn't change the official outcome of the trial, which was a mistrial. And the idea of using post-trial juror statements to retroactively declare an acquittal, that's a big leap the courts have consistently refused to make. What Reed's team is effectively asking for is a new exception to existing rules. They want the Supreme Court to say that a unanimous but unannounced jury decision in the deliberation room should be treated as legally binding, even though it never made it into the record. That's a novel position. But novelty isn't enough to get the court's attention. The justices usually wait until multiple appellate courts have issued conflicting opinions on a legal question before stepping in. That hasn't happened here. Every court has come down on the same side. So, what happens next? As of now, the retrial in Dedham continues. Jury selection is active. No stay or delay has been ordered by the Supreme Court. That means the trial will proceed unless the justices, or one of them, suddenly decide to put a temporary stop to things. That's always a possibility, especially if Reed's attorneys filed a companion emergency motion for a stay, which they likely did. But unless and until such a stay is granted, Judge Cannone has no legal obligation to pause proceedings. It's worth pointing out that the jury sitting in this second trial is entirely unaware of this Supreme Court petition. They have no idea this constitutional fight is happening in parallel. That's by design. Jurors are instructed not to read media coverage, not to research the case, and certainly not to discuss it outside the courtroom. The Double Jeopardy petition isn't something they'll hear about during the trial, and it won't be part of the evidence or arguments they're asked to consider. The judge has also likely imposed a media gag order or reminded the parties not to let this legal fight bleed into the courtroom narrative. From a trial management standpoint, that's essential. If jurors even got a hint that the defense was trying to end the trial from the outside, it could create bias or confusion. So for them, the case is unfolding as if this constitutional issue doesn't exist. Now, if the Supreme Court does decide to hear the case, which again is unlikely but not impossible, the timing becomes important. Would they rule fast enough to stop the trial midstream? That's extremely rare. The court's review process moves slowly. Even emergency petitions can take weeks to resolve. The more likely scenario is that they let the trial run its course, then decide later whether to review the double jeopardy claim after a verdict is reached. That outcome has its own complications. If Reed is acquitted on all counts, the issue becomes moot. You can't be retried again if you've been acquitted. The constitutional claim essentially dies on the vine. But if she's convicted, especially on one of the two charges her attorneys say were already resolved by the first jury, then the double jeopardy argument becomes part of her post-conviction appeal. In that case, the Supreme Court could choose to hear it later once the appellate process is in full swing and all facts are on the table. And what if the Supreme Court sides with her? Well, that would be seismic. If the court agrees that the first jury's internal vote counts as an acquittal, it would not only invalidate any retrial convictions on those charges, it would potentially bar prosecutors across the country from retrying defendants under similar circumstances. It would mark a major shift in how mistrials and hung juries are interpreted. Judges would have to think twice before declaring mistrials without first polling jurors on each charge. It could force a whole new layer of deliberation procedure into trials that are already complicated and high stakes. On the flip side, if the court denies the petition outright, that's it. Game over, at least on this particular issue. The retrial proceeds to its natural conclusion, and the defense would have to challenge any conviction through more traditional post-trial motions and appeals. One other piece worth noting is the logistical pressure. The defense has had to juggle two enormous tasks at once, preparing for trial in real time, while also crafting a constitutional appeal at the highest possible level. That's not a small thing. Supreme Court petitions are dense, time-consuming, and require meticulous legal groundwork. Doing that while navigating daily voir dire, filing motions, and managing media coverage is a balancing act that not many defense teams ever have to perform. But for now, they're doing both. Fighting the case on the ground in Dedham and simultaneously trying to change the legal game entirely from 450 miles away. So in real terms, the situation is this. The trial is moving forward, the jury is being seated, and everyone in that courtroom is operating under the assumption that it will proceed normally. The justices in Washington haven't said anything yet. They may never say anything. But until they do, or unless they issue an order to stop it, Massachusetts law remains in full force, and the charges Karen Reed is facing remain very much alive. All of that makes this moment an unusually tense intersection of two legal worlds, the procedural, day-to-day grind of a murder trial, and the high-altitude constitutional review of the Supreme Court. They rarely cross paths. When they do, the stakes are enormous, and in this case, they're still rising.
He was charming. Handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool, but financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool, but financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.